Okay, we're into part two, a game of chess. And let me get this back up on the screen. Most of this begins with a long description of this woman, kind of at her, you know, makeup table, making herself up, and it's kind of overly ornate. One of the things that Ezra Pound did, who helped Eliot edit down the poem was almost twice as long as it is now. This was a section that he really said, look, you need to cut a lot of this stuff out. Anyway, one of the things, and the reason I stopped here, Philomel, this is another one of the strands woven through the poem, is this whole Greek myth about the birth of the nightingale, that this king, Tereus, was lusting for his wife's sister, Philomel, or Philomela, and it's in the Ovid's Metamorphoses.
She
had her tongue cut out so that he couldn't tell that he had raped her.
Mm-hmm.
And so eventually she wove a tapestry that told of his lies, and I think they cut up the king's son and fed him to the king. And of course, they all went crazy chasing after each other. And then in the moment of metamorphosis, the gods changed Tereus into a falcon, and Philomel, the tongueless one, became the beautiful singing nightingale. And of course, the nightingale goes back to Keats' nightingale, especially, and still she cried and still the world pursues, almost seems to pull both Ode from a Nightingale and Ode on a Grecian Urn. Ode on a Grecian Urn, with that girl being pursued by the guy forever. But it brings into it rape, passion, these things that are changeable, but the things that, you know, are part of this world, you know, and especially the type of things that keep the world turning. So it's just this picture on a mantle, yet he starts to meditate upon it. And from this picture, we move into the better section, I think, of this. We'll stop briefly. One thing we didn't talk about yesterday with preludes was, what are they preludes to? Preludes to action, preludes to meaning, preludes to some kind of self-knowledge, revelation. And I think that's what's happening here. We've got this husband and wife, man and woman, and a lot of people take this to be Eliot and his wife Vivian, who, I mean, both of them suffered from depression, manic depression. You know, whether Eliot caught it from her or not, I don't know, but her voice is very strong. I mean, you can almost see her as the muse of this poem. Yet again, we've got that lack of communication. What are you thinking? I never know what you're thinking. Think. And he is thinking, except he's not communicating it, at least to her. I think we are in Rat's Alley, where the dead men lost their bones. The dead men have lost the only thing they've got left. What's that noise? The wind. So again, we've got back to that wind symbolism. You know, is there meaning in the wind or not? No, instead there's just nothing. Do you know nothing? Do you see nothing? Do you remember nothing? I remember those are pearls that were his eyes, which is a literary reference to Shakespeare. And a time that Eliot writes about in Tradition and in Individual Talent and in other places, where thought and feeling were one, where you had a unified culture, where you had the true capacity to create art, not this mechanized culture that is falling in to, you know, the big pit after World War I. Are you alive or not? Is there nothing in your head? And then he goes into this, oh, that Shakespearean rag. It's so elegant. It's so intelligent. which actually there was a song called the Shakespearean Rag. And, you know, we don't think about it now, but 1922 records were a pretty new thing. So this is kind of the latest thrill. And later we're going to have a woman with a gramophone. So that's going to be another thread. So what are they going to do? Well, they're going to, you know, am I going to run out of the street like a crazy woman, you know, and try to force something to happen? I'm tired of this limbo, this prelude to nothingness. But instead, it'll be hot water at 10 and a closed car at 4. And they'll play a game of chess, pressing lidless eyes and waiting for a knock upon the door, waiting for something to happen. I mean, you can really see a lot of Samuel Beckett coming right out of this poem. The idea of waiting for the authentic moment, waiting for existence to happen, meaning to happen. What's a game of chess represent?
It depends on how you look at it. Like, for example, Jarvis and I play chess like 2-3 times a week, but it's because he doesn't have patience, and I don't really know how to checkmate. So it's like we're trying to learn patience, which pieces to give up, which aren't important, which things are important, the power of the pawn, the power of the queen, or the powerlessness of the queen, stuff like that. Chess is a game of will, patience, and power.
It's also a game of strategy.
Yeah.
Where, in this case, it seems like they're having a verbal chess match with their little argument. Mm. I mean, in a way, I see that he's taunting her in some cases.
Me too.
When she does, do you know nothing? Do you see nothing? Do you remember nothing? He's like mocking her with, I remember, and then he quotes Shakespeare at her.
Although this seems to be an interior monologue,
so
it's a question. He almost sounds like the abused husband who, I remember those were pearls that were his eyes.
I mean, she's nagging him, so I'm pretty sure he's just like, you know, finding something that he likes. For example, he likes Shakespeare, so that's what he's concentrating on because he doesn't want to think about her.
Well, even if it's an interior monologue, I mean, it's a rejoinder that he's not even sharing it with her, and that's the one thing that she wants is for him to communicate with her, and he's denying her that one thing that she wants.
Exactly. Very good.
And with that mocking, I remember Shakespeare.
And a game of chess is a game, you know, of antagonists, of black and white. It's a game, like you said, of strategy and power, and it's a way to pass time instead of try to, you know, have something meaningful all the time. You're waiting for that knock on the door that somebody's going to arrive and deliver us from this situation. Now, what happens in this next scene is we essentially move from the upper class person and their kind of senseless existence down to, as in Shakespeare, you go down to the commoners and their kind of foil or similar situation. And hurry up, please, it's time, is something that would be said at the end of when they would be calling last call for drinks in these British pubs. So that's why it keeps getting repeated, although it's also significant, you know, hurry up, please, it's time. You know, something's going to happen. We're finally going to have that revel, although we never do.